as a solution to the problem. Because certainly the problem is there and it's very real, and we have tried in solutions. The main thing that we have tried in trying to meet a solution to this problem is to meet with the missionary that is to the north of us and try to work out some kind of understanding with him. We feel that there should be more of a feeling of fellowship. We try to assure them that we're not cutting off anybody from our fellowship, that any time we want to have fellowship together, that you're welcome to do so. However, it doesn't want it that way. It prefers to make a clear line of distinction. Other missionaries, the ones in Zamboanga and other parts of the Philippines, have not taken that attitude. We do have fellowship, even though we differ on prophetic things. We have fellowship. It's just this one individual in the whole Philippines that wants to make a difference. And so the problem becomes acute, and we don't hardly know what to do about it. And now the problem has come to the place where he has announced publicly to his brethren in the States and through his particular religious papers such statements as there is no church, no true church in the Philippine Islands, in Manila. Statements such as that, and that his ambition was to establish a church in Manila, which of course is right in the center of our activities. And this he has recently done. He has rented a place not far from us and has started a new congregation. That has already been begun.
Among the Filipino people?
Yes, among Filipino people.
He can't worry about the Chinese people.
No, he can't bother the Chinese because
they
don't know English anyway. All of the services are in English. And when he does have a native Filipino language service that is preaching, he imports one of his preachers from up north and he's preached in the Ilocano dialect, which is not the native Filipino dialect, even then. But carrying on in English, all Filipinos will understand. So there is a definite conflict that's already begun, even within our own city where we are working. Now, we have no objections to them starting another work. That's fine. We're glad that a work can be started and it can be expanded if we can not be fussing about it. That's the thing. That is the problem. And so we tried not to have any fussing other than what they might want to do. They can go ahead and do what they want, but we'll just mind our own business and keep going. He's trying to raise funds to put up a building down there. And so there is a definite problem that we're facing. The Filipinos don't understand that problem. They don't know why all of this trouble. They know that there's differences in understanding of the scripture on this, and some of them have loyalty one way because of the money part of it, or perhaps because of certain pressures that have been put on them, but they don't see the sense in it all. And in fact, we've had numbers from that other congregation that has visited with us and have attended worship, but they come secretly and they want it to be known that the word is not to get out that they ever came, because they're afraid of the wrath of that missionary. He might get very angry with them. But many of them have come. Almost every Sunday there's somebody, at least somebody, that comes, and maybe several that worship, come and worship, and some have expressed interest even in attending our Bible classes through the week, or attending the school classes, but they are afraid. Sort of a little bit like Nicodemus at night, I guess, coming by night. There is that problem, and we are very sorry that there is such a thing. The other missionaries that are in fellowship with him don't feel the same way. They come and they worship with us, and we have good fellowship together. We even have to share our home with them when they come up to Manila. They feel very differently.
He used to, yes,
until someone put pressure on him. So we don't really know what to do about this problem. It's putting a very divided front before the natives, before the Filipino people. They can't understand that. Other religions, other denominations and so on have a unity among themselves. Oh yes, the Catholics are very much unified. They don't have any fussing or quarreling among themselves. But even among the denominations, there's not much. Now, the Baptists have a little bit. Between the Southern Baptists and the American Baptists, there is some fussing between them. But When they say, well, here you both say you're the New Testament church and so on, and both teach the same thing as far as first principles are concerned, and your worship is the same and everything's the same, why the fuss? They don't understand that. Well, frankly, I don't understand it either. I don't know why they should have to have a fuss. I think there's one Filipino brother, he puts it this way, says we should be agreed to disagree. Well, maybe we shouldn't go quite that far, agree to disagree, but still, there shouldn't be a fuss, and so there is a problem that they just simply can't understand. And it gives them a divided front. Now, what would you do in a case like that? I don't know. We have just about come to the end. We don't know what way to turn next to try and keep showing. We'll always want to show a sense of love. Anytime they want to come, we'll welcome them. Anytime for shares will come. He's still welcome to stay in our home. Maybe it's the wrong thing. I don't know. Maybe we should just openly just say, all right, if that's the way it is, we'll cut you off. I don't know. But we haven't taken that stand.
Is he still
coming? Coming where?
To our place?
No, he doesn't come to our place at all. He comes to Manila lots of times, but he never comes to our house.
No more?
No more. He hasn't come there for 2 years now.
Oh.
Well, not 2 years. More than 1 year, anyway. So, he has done this. This is rather bad. One of the congregations has been started in the suburb of Manila. He has been going to that congregation in our absence when he knows that we are engaged in another place and we can't be there at a service. He has gone there and has tried to lead some of the people away from us. Well, of course, we don't care if they go away from us. The thing we're interested in is, will they go away from the Lord? What they know is right. But he has stirred up that congregation very much, and which kind of hurts us a little bit. He had nothing to do in the starting of that work. He just came in. In fact, we helped him. When he was still friendly with us, he got from us the names and addresses of all of the leaders of the congregation and sent them his papers, and then pretty soon he was writing them personal letters and inviting them to come up to Baguio. And he wanted to discuss things with them. And we gave him the names and addresses. And as a result, we've lost one of the church leaders there. Of course, he offered to pay him rather large sums of money to come up there. To put him by him. So there's a real problem. I don't know. Robert, do you have this kind of experience? You know what to do about it?
Just have a little bit as possible.
Little as possible, do with it. Well, now here's the thing.
They won't have anything to do with you.
It isn't they. It is he.
Like he does. Well, he controls the people.
He controls the people, but most of the people don't understand. They just sort of follow him. They don't know what it's all about. If the people were like him, well, that's easy then. I mean, just have as little to do as possible and recognize him as another denomination themselves, like anybody else. But the people aren't that way. Some of them have yielded because of pressures and because of money, but most of them don't know what it's all about. They're afraid of him. They don't know what to do about it. I think some of them would like to learn the truth. That's the thing I'm wondering about. Now, I do know it's possible to have people of both beliefs to be in the same congregation and meeting together. That can be done. At least up until recently, maybe even yet, at Sellersburg, there has been numbers of a different belief, and they meet together. In Gallatin, it was true until recently, until some of them pulled out and formed their own church down the road away. At Adamsville, there's some too, isn't there? I think your own uncle, isn't he one? Well, I know my own uncle too down at Lancaster. I've got one kind of, oh, well, he's a great uncle, he's my grandfather's brother. He's very rabid, extremely rabid. And some can get along all right. There's just this one case. I don't know. Maybe you're right. Just have as little to do with them as possible. But when there's people that are curious to know what is the truth, you can't hardly turn your back on them.
Well, how do you mean by teaching them? I say if they come to your Bible classes, then. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's your opportunity, but Otherwise, he keeps him like that. The only thing you could do is do the same thing he did to your
congregation. To invade him. Well, we haven't invaded his, except some of our Filipino boys that are in the school, and they're very energetic and zealous and enthusiastic bunch of kids. They don't mind walking in where the lion den is. They have gone over there. I hope they didn't say anything that they shouldn't have said, stir up trouble, because we don't want to be known as troublemakers. If you go to any end to avoid that kind of reputation. We don't want to be known as troublemakers and church dividers. There's nothing he would like better than to be able to accuse us of such a thing.
Well, generally, they don't have to cut any grounds for their attitude.
No, generally they don't, but he can't make such an accusation because the people know better. If he was to say it, he'd be alone in saying it. So he can't very well afford to say it yet. The least little bit of grounds he can get, he'll capitalize on it. Don't worry. Well, it's a real problem with this. Well, ignoring that, let's get to the work in Manila that we are doing, and let's criticize that. When we went to Manila in 1951, we found nothing in the way of Christian work among Filipinos. We understood, and in fact this book, The Harvest Field, tells about student center work that was started back in 1928 by Brother Cassell, and some kind of work that had been done there, but we found no traces, no evidence of anything when we arrived in 1951. So we had to start really from the bottom. Now here's the problem of our own work. Let's ignore Bashir's now from now on out. But the problem of our own work among Filipinos has been this. Manila is a metropolitan center of the Philippine Islands, a city of about 3 million people, including its environs, of course, including the suburbs. And people have come from every place for business reasons, for education. Most of the younger people have come there for educational purposes because the colleges and universities are there, many of them. And so we have a group of people from everywhere. And the beginning of our church was made up of a few American businessmen and their families, and some Filipinos who have come from Mindanao and other provinces of the Philippines who have come there for certain purposes. These people were already members of the church. They are a conglomeration of many methods and techniques and missionary activity. As we've been studying before, we took up all different areas and what had been done in those areas, some of them indigenous, some of them not, some of them this way, some of them that way. They have all different types of background in teaching and in teaching methods and in the organization of the church. Well, our congregation is made up from people from all of these different places, not all of them, but many of them. And so we've got quite a mixture, a hodgepodge of people that are there. Some of them understanding a little bit about indigenous methods, but most of them not. And we've even got two ex-preachers in the congregation. One of them is the one that had the trouble in Zamboanga that moved up to Manila because of the fuss he had with the other preacher that was there. The other one was one who had a fuss with Bashir's and moved down from there. So we've got two preachers, neither one of them doing much of any preaching. One of them not at all, the other one just occasionally. But they've just about gotten discouraged on taking meeting parts in church work and said, what's the use? You get started doing something, then somebody slaps you down. That's just the way they feel about it. They feel like they can't get ahead in the Lord's work. Well, probably mission methods have been responsible for that. The missionary didn't want them to get too far advanced, which I think was a mistake. We tried to promote them, get them to go on and preach more and take responsibility, but they don't want it. So we've got two, one from the north and one from the south, two preachers that aren't doing much of any preaching. We have young people who have been brought up in many different backgrounds. And there they are, speaking many dialects of Philippine language. I guess, I don't know how many dialects are actually represented in our congregation. Would you have any idea?
No.
Many of them. Because Cotabato has one dialect, and Zamboanga has another dialect, and Leyte has another dialect, and up in the north we have about two or three dialects.
9 or 10.
Do they understand each other, or do they speak English?
They all speak English. They don't understand each other in their own dialects. English is the medium of conversation, because it's the only way they can talk to each other. all of them understand
Spanish,
English.
Spanish, no, a little bit, but English.
No, not too much. Not even. The younger people don't know much about Spanish anymore. It's the older ones. They used to have to study in school. So English is the medium of conversation. Sometimes Tagalog, which is supposed to be the national dialect. But many people in other parts of the Philippines, they don't care anything about Tagalog. They're very proud of their own language, and they wonder, why did they choose Tagalog as a national language? Why not our language? And so they're not willing to learn. They're sectional prejudice, you might say, provincial prejudice.
Do all of them study English in school?
Yes, the medium of instruction in school is by English.
And
all classes, except the national language class, is conducted in the English language. All their textbooks are printed in America. Well, not all of them now, but they used to be. Some of them printed in the Philippines now, but still in English. So if they learn arithmetic, they learn it by medium of English, not in their own language. They learn science, they learn it through English, not in their own language. Anything, everything is learned in English. Well, one thing is the reason for this, their language is inadequate, particularly in the field of science. They just simply don't have adequate vocabulary. Their language is quite primitive. Tagalog is more highly developed, but it is developed only in a literary sense and follows the Spanish pattern. But scientifically and mathematically and so on, they don't have terms for things, so they just use English. So they all converse in English. But there they are, we have this hodgepodge of people there, with every shade of doctrine and belief and background and everything. Now it's a job, what you can do with these people. They want to worship. Certain basic things they agree to. That is, they worship without instrumental music, the Lord's Supper each first day of the week, and practically every one of them will quote you faith, repentance, confession, baptism. And there they are. Well, it is a little difficult. Some of them are there temporarily, some of them are transient, particularly the student group. They go there maybe 4 years to college, or if they're studying for a lawyer or a doctor, they may stay maybe as many as 8 years. And then they go back, some of them, many of them don't. And so they would be transient. We may have, during the school year, we may have a full house all of the time, but during summer vacation, only about half full, because of the student group that is absent.
During harvest, too.
And during harvest, yes. Well, it's quite a problem to know just what is the best approach to these people. We really have a problem. We don't know what to do lots of times. What I feel is the best thing is to have more individual attention to the people, to work with them individually. But now that's a problem to us because we don't have time to do that. It really takes personal evangelism, seems to me, that you need to go to their home and to talk with them, discuss with them, and lead them on in a study until they can come to some sort of a level with everyone else. Then your preaching can have a lot more meaning, but you preach a sermon on one particular topic and you may hit just a small group of people and the rest of them sit back and don't know what you're talking about, or they don't care, or maybe it doesn't apply to them. You preach on another subject and you hit another small group. So in our preaching we have to use such broad generalities that, well, it's so difficult to really stir into the heart of the people and get some definite response. Their religious backgrounds are terribly confused. Besides Roman Catholicism, there's a lot that have come out of different denominations. This Manalo sect, we've had a few from them, and various denominations. So there's a real problem that we face, and well, at least that's my idea, is that we need more personal contact. Is there anything that you might think of that might be useful in meeting the problems that are there, besides personal contact? This is something we can't very well carry on by ourselves, because both of us are so tied down with teaching work and preaching and teaching in several congregations in different languages, and trying to keep up with what's going on in some of the churches in the provinces, and keep up with what's going on in Hong Kong, and keeping up with about 15 things all at the same time. We just don't have time to get around and do much visiting, and that's where we really, really are lacking.
And they live far.
And they lived scattered, yes. Not far from the city, but far from each other in the city. Imagine if you can, a city of 3 million population. It covers quite a wide area, a wide territory. It takes, how far is it from one end? Let's say from Grace Park to Paranaque, how far? About 15 miles? Well, that's the quality of the road. I was thinking just simply of distance. The streets are pretty rough, that's true, and it takes quite a long time. It may take you at least an hour to go from limit to limit. Well, I suppose it's about 15 miles, maybe about that, from north to south through the city. And east to west, maybe just about the same, isn't it? Maybe not quite so much out to Quezon City that way. So you've got a wide area, and the Christians are the people who have come there to church. One lives way up there in the northern end, and another lives way down here at the southern end, and another one is over there. So a person doing personal work should have a car. It's just about the only thing you can do, have a car and be able to get around. And it's going to be a tremendous gasoline bill just keeping up with personal visitation work. And it takes a lot of time to get around a big city like that. And they are scattered. You don't find them living close to each other, not like in the Chinese community. And so that's the reason we haven't done it. We just simply haven't done it.
And not home either. Not.
Well, of course, that's true with any group of people. You have to find the times when they're at home.
So they stay at home after they get married.
Well, the men are out working, though. They have to work for their living.
The husbands go out, but the wives, most of the time, stay home.
Yeah, that's true. Filipino wives also work.
They,
Chinese wives.
Not,
some do, but not much.
Not much. If they have children, they never work. If they don't have children, they work. If they are, I mean, some work at home, you know, for example, sew a handkerchief, or, you know, they will get it from the factory. They work at home instead of go outside.
Yeah, there's some home industries like that, making envelopes, sewing, stitching hems on handkerchiefs and things that come around from the factory and give them a stack, a few thousand, and they work at home. Some of the ladies do that.
And
among the Chinese, but Filipinos, no. Many of them work. Well, personal visitation, I guess, is the thing. Nobody's come up with anything different. But as I see it, it seems that the need would be for another missionary who can handle that kind of thing. We just can't handle it. Maybe that way we could work with them better. And in that way also, we could branch out and reach other people. By meeting in their homes, we could meet their neighbors too and be able to bring others. That's one of the secrets of success in the Chinese work, was the personal visitation and the fact that you could get the neighbors of those people. They sometimes have a little meeting in their home. We haven't done that with Filipinos at all. So that's the local situation in Manila. Now, as far as our own personal not our personal work, but the Lord's work, as we are doing it in Manila, we have several programs of activity among Filipinos. We have not only the church work, but these suburbs congregations have been started, and we usually hold evangelistic meetings occasionally, and have midweek Bible classes that we help out in. Filipino men preach and do the, they have most of the responsibility, in fact, have all the responsibility of those suburban congregations. They take care of the finance and everything. All we do is just go in there and help in the teaching now and then. And they bear the responsibility. Our idea is that they should be indigenous. And I think they pretty much are. They don't own any property, but still, outside of that, they're still indigenous. We have no control over them. We do not dictate or give orders or anything of the sort. They take care of all of their own work, and we teach and preach by invitation from them. There's that. Then we have our hospital work, which of course is just strictly a mission work. We have regular classes at the tuberculosis hospital. I've probably talked about that at other times when you've heard me, so I don't need to go into that more. So, but among the Filipinos, I guess that's about it, except for our trips out into the provinces, but then that gets into those other fields. Well, let's go on then into the next part of mission work in the Philippines. So far we've been in part one. Remember, the part one was the Roman Catholic part. That is the majority group. We divided the Philippines into four parts. It was first was Roman Catholic, next was the Mohammedan, and then the next would be pagan, and then finally the Chinese work. So far we've just been talking about the Roman Catholic population. That is the majority population, and when you speak of work among Filipinos, that's usually what is in mind. Now these others, I guess in a technical sense, I mean, no, not in a technical sense, but in a general sense, you call them Filipinos too, because they are natives of the Philippine Islands, but to be real technical, they don't quite, some of the people don't quite consider them along with the rest of the Filipinos. The Mohammedans are a race of their own. They are of a different racial stock, and the rest of the Filipinos don't quite, they're counted as Filipinos officially on the record, but they don't count them as Filipinos in society. These people are called Moros, the Mohammedan people. They are a racial people of their own. They are tribal in nature. Not tribal in the same way that the pagan tribes are, but they are still tribal people. They have rather peculiar construction of their bodies, high cheekbones, quite high and broad faces, and rather muscularly built, heavy-set type of people, very strong. They're very different from the normal Filipino people. The normal Filipino people are slight, that is, they're small bones, small built. Some of them are a little larger, of course, there's variety in any race. And they are people who even have a slight timid look. Filipino people seem to look a little bit timid. They're not really, but...
They turn more or less flat off. If you're afraid of them, they chase you. If you're not afraid of them,
that's exactly what was in my mind. I just didn't want to say it. I was trying to think of another way of saying it without bringing up the word dog. People get highly insulted if you call them a dog. But that is. I hope Charles won't get this repeated anywhere. Do you hear me, Charles? Get me in trouble with the Filipinos. But it is true. It's very much the Filipino people that we've been talking about are very much like the type of a dog that's real bold and brave if you're running. They can bark and chase after you. If you turn on them, then they've got their tail between the legs, and they're doing the running. See? I mean, that's sort of the impression that you get. That's not, you shouldn't use dogs for illustration. Never. I think it was Charles Wilson, wasn't it, that got himself in trouble using dogs as an illustration. But, so don't repeat me, please. But that is the impression. Now, the Moros are very different from that. They are a people that you can take one look at them and they are standing straight, very erect, like they are proud to be who they are. Their heads and shoulders are straight. Their neck is straight. And they look this way. When you talk with them, they look you straight in the eye. Filipino, the normal Filipino doesn't. He looks around and down at his feet and they're shifty eyes. So. But the Moros are not. They're very straightforward. And they have a real bearing. It looks like a person of character. You can see in their eyes a very determined look, a definite look. I think you can understand what I mean. As a race, they tend to be that way. Now, I'm sure that there are Moros also who are rather shifty-eyed. But as a race, the majority of them are very erect, very definite, stand firm, perhaps a lot more so than even Americans. They are proud people. Now, these people are in the southern islands, mostly in the southern parts of Mindanao and Jolo and some of those places. There's a tendency among those people to be fanatical in their religion. These are Mohammedans, and they have a tendency to be fanatics. And you have to be very careful when they are fanatical. You know what I mean by fanatic? Okay. They're proud, and therefore, because of their pride in their race and in their religion, they are very much against Filipinos. They are very bitter against the not just Roman Catholic religion, it isn't that, the rest of the Filipino people. They think that they are superior to them. Now, the Filipino people are the ruling people of the Philippine Islands. The Tagalogs, that particular race, are the superior race as far as government is concerned, but these morals, they are very bitter. They think that they ought to be the superior race, that they ought to have control. And so they are very much against Filipinos and against anyone else who would try to govern them, to have control over them or dominate them. They are very much against them. So any group of people who would indicate or even hint that we're going to rule over you, well, they'll turn against you. They just simply can't be ruled over. They have never been ruled over in all of their history that is known. No one has been able to absolutely dominate and control them. The Philippine government today still doesn't really rule over them.
They don't.
Yeah, anytime they send a governor or a marshal or somebody down there to try and bring more absolute control over the moral section, now he's just found dead. So they have a very loose form of government over the moral people. And the morals have a great deal of freedom. Many of the laws of the Philippines do not apply to morals. They can apply to everybody else and the foreigner that comes there and everybody, but not to morals. They defy the law and they get away with it because they're just simply not going to be ruled over. Well, one of the laws of the Philippines is that you shall have only one wife. The morals, being Mohammedans, believe that you can have more than one wife. You can have up to four wives. So they do. And you can't bring a charge against a moral on bigamy. You can to anybody else. There can be a charge of bigamy and they can be thrown in jail for it. But not immoral. Philippine law just doesn't apply. If a moral was to be tried for bigamy, there'd be a revolution. In fact, there are revolutions going on practically all the time anyhow. Another thing, nobody else dare smuggle anything into the country from another country without paying customs and taxes. The morals smuggle it in freely from Borneo and Java. They just bring it in by the shipboats. And the Philippine Navy has sent down ships there to try to stop them, but they don't dare. They don't dare do too much. They might fire a few shots just to sort of say we've done something in protection of our borders, but that's all. Because a moral ship in just, well, not the big ship loads. By ships, I mean their own moral type of boats. They're small boats, sailboats. But they come in, you can go down Zamboanga and buy smuggled in stuff from just about any country in the world. Cheap, you buy it cheap down there. And they just, yes, down Zamboanga, they ship it out and bring it up through Holo and so on, bring it in there. You can get this Indonesian, what they call this batik material that they make sarongs out of, very, very expensive in Manila. It's specially hand-dyed. They put wax in places and then dye it and then take off the wax and put it in. It makes very fancy designs. It's quite expensive in most places, but in Zamboanga you can buy it cheap because the morals smuggled it. And cigarettes are cheap down there. Why go to pearls? Oh, yes. They're pearl divers, too. The morals are pearl divers. And you can get all kinds of pearls there. They smuggle pearls in and out all the time. And just lots of things. Of course, they defy the government and they get away with it. They don't dare fire on a moral and kill him for smuggling or some of those things for fear that there'll be a revolution. So that's the kind of people they are. They shed blood easily. They're not afraid to kill someone. They're not afraid to die. If it means their own life just to take another life, but they feel that it's necessary to take that life, they're not afraid to die. They'll go and take it. And however, they will not normally, unless it's accidentally, they will not take the life of another Mohammedan, another person of their own faith. Now, if one of their own tribe changes faith, they don't hesitate to kill him. But if their own faith, they will not kill him. And they will kill over religion, usually, not so much now. They used to. They would get into a fanatic spell. They'd sort of like some churches around here, they get the spirit, you know, they get started that way. Well, they get it in a different way. They get it in such a way that they go out to kill, particularly Christians. And that's what we call over there going hermantada. It's a religious fanatic feeling that they go just with the idea of killing as many as they can before they die themselves. They know they're going to be killed themselves. fact, when occasionally there's somebody gets up to Manila that's like that. Not too long ago, we had a man that was in Manila, and he had a rifle. And he started shooting. He just indiscriminately shot into crowds of people, went to the marketplace and was shooting. He's trying to kill as many as he could. And the police converged on the spot. I don't know, were you there then, that time? He was out near Central Market. And we were trying to get the police for another thing at the same time. We didn't know all this was going on. We saw police car after police car whiz by our house, sirens screaming. We thought, here comes somebody to our rescue. There was a riot right across the street from us. It was a house of prostitution. We were having a riot. And we were calling the police. So they didn't have time to fool with us. It was this man was going for a mentado. So they raced out there. They finally caught him, the man, and shot him down dead. But I don't know how many lives it was he took before he died. It was all for a good cause, according to their faith. Now, there's not as much of that today as there used to be. It's when a case like that happens, it makes a newspaper now. Now it's on the front page. But 10 years ago or more, you'd probably find it on page 5. It was so common. But there was that tendency. So this makes a problem for missionaries. Missionaries are a little bit scared of it. They don't know what to do. Yet, on the other hand, these people can be very polite. They can be very hospitable. If you come among them as their guest, they would be willing to die before any harm can come to you. And if they accept you as a guest, no one else can touch you. But of course, you must be careful. Don't offend them. And they can be very hospitable. If they will accept you as a guest, everything in their house is at your disposal. Their home is your home. That isn't really a contrast either. It's not a contradiction. They're that kind of people. They feel that way. They're that way to their own people. And generally, they like Americans, which makes an advantage for missionaries. Now, they don't like all Americans, but they like Americans in general. Now, they didn't used to. A couple of generations ago, when America took over the Philippines, they tried to bring the Moros under control, and they didn't like the Americans then. They fought them. They would charge in and charge over the dead bodies of the ones that had fallen before them. In fact, the 45 pistol that we have was invented and manufactured originally for the purpose of fighting Moros, because they found that in the olden times, the older guns that they used couldn't stop them. The bullets would just pass on through them. And they had enough fanatic zeal that they could come on in spite of being shot. That after they had been shot, they would still kill the soldier that shot them. That was back in the early part of 1900. So the 45 pistol was invented for that purpose, because the caliber was so big and the bullet hit with such a splash, it was spread out as it hit, that it would knock them down as well as to hit them. It not only struck them with the bullet, but it also knocked them over, because it hit with such a powerful force. That was the original cause of the invention of the 45. Because they would sometimes get so close that they have to use that to prevent the soldier that did the shooting from being killed too. And at one time they were very much against the Americans, but during the last World War they came to love the Americans, because there was American bases set up among them, and the soldiers gave them food and were just so hospitable to them that they got to liking them. And now they believe in the Americans as the champions of freedom. They look to America as the nation that would give freedom to all other countries, and they respect that. And so Americans have a high degree of respectability. In fact, many Filipino officials have made this statement, that they wouldn't dare walk into a Moro forest. If they want some information, they'd like to ask an American to go. An American can walk into a Moro forest and be friends with them, but not a Filipino, because the Filipinos are the rulers, and they kill them. Well, there's a slight advantage there. These people, these Moros, want independence. They want to be an independent nation. That's what they want. They want to secede from the Philippine government and form a nation of their own. But they haven't been able to do that. Well, some of them will go so far as to admit that they would like to be rulers over the whole Philippine Islands. They would like to dominate all of the Philippines, but not many will say things like that, just a few. Well, there's the background of these Mohammedan people. It's almost like a horror story in some aspects of it. But what has been done among them, some denominations in these areas have schools for Filipinos, and some Moros have come to get education. They have attended their schools. However, the numbers are very few, and there's such a strong prejudice between Moros and the others of the Filipinos that it's very difficult to reach them even then. But there are a few Moros in school.
Moro is also a Filipino.
Yes, he's a Filipino officially.
Uh-huh.
But the Filipino people themselves hesitate to call them Filipinos. They don't like to call them that. That's why I speak of Moro and Filipino as if they were two different groups. They are Filipinos officially because they are natives of the Philippine Islands. That's the only way that they are Filipinos. But they are different from the majority group. There's about a half million of them. Occasionally, some of them come to the denominational churches that are in their area. But as far as actual missionary work, there is very little. There are a few churches. I know of one couple. I don't know what denomination, if any. They may be Christian Missionary Alliance people. I'm not sure about that. But I know of one couple. I've met them and talked with them that have a mission among Moro people. They say it's extremely difficult. They are on friendly terms with them, and it's deep in the jungle. They're 3 days' journey by banca boat, that's a little outrigger boat, up a river, up interior by a river, 3 days' journey from the nearest telephone or telegraph or anything of that sort. And they're deep in the jungle, so if they have to get word out and news, it's pretty difficult for them to get out. But they are on friendly terms, and they've been able to do something. But I don't know just how much they have been able to do. They say it's hard work. They've tried to start a little school there. I don't know of any Bible in their dialects. I don't know of any. Now, the Bible has been translated into Arabic, and the Moro tribal leaders speak Arabic because the Mohammedans require that they understand, at least the leaders of their religion, understand Arabic. And so that is possible for the leaders. But for the common people, they have various dialects in their own tribes, and I don't know of any. There might be, it's possible, but I don't know of it. You'd have to check with the American Bible Society about that. As for missionaries who speak their dialects, I don't know of any. There might be, it's possible that I haven't met them and I don't know who they are. It's possible, but I don't know of any missionaries that speak any of their tribal dialects. That they usually reach them by means of English or something else. But the general attitude of missions has been that of fear. They're afraid of the people. That has been the general attitude. They're scared of them. And so whatever mission work has been done, it's more or less sort of doing it at arm's length. It's sort of holding you back over here and real tight. There's no intimate contact, if you understand what I mean. It's sort of trying to do mission work a little bit from a distance, so we won't get too close. And that has been the general progress, and they seem to, at least when they are not among them, I doubt if they say this when they are among them, but when they're not among them, they show an attitude of distrust. They're afraid to trust them. Now, other people have gone there. Sociologists, archaeologists have gone among Moro people and have lived among them and said that they have felt perfectly safe among Moro people. But of course, these are people that are not trying to teach a different religion. Archaeologists and sociologists that are going there, they are there merely for the purpose of studying their way of life and studying their religion, and they're very glad to receive them. Now, if they were going to teach a new religion, it might be a different problem. But since they're only going to learn and not to teach them, they receive them. In fact, one sociologist that I know of, I have never met him, but he's teaching at University of Philippines. He's an American professor, a PhD. And he has gone among the Moro people, and he says, I feel safer among the Moros than I do among the Filipinos. He says, if you walk down the street in Manila, they'll pick your pocket or stick a gun in your back. I don't know. I've never had a gun stuck in my back, except by those Maoistas. But he said they'll do that, but among Moros, they said they honor and respect their guest. And if anything is taken from them, if any other Moro should steal something from them, no matter how little, that if they can catch that person is in terrible trouble. If they don't catch him, the rest of the Moros will pay it back. That he must leave from that place with no less than when he arrived. that when he gets ready to leave, he must leave with nothing less. Anything that is stolen, the tribe themselves will feel guilty. If any member of their tribe stole anything, the tribe themselves will feel guilty and will reimburse it. He says, well, I feel a lot safer among these people than I do among these Filipinos. Well, of course, it's their tribal pride makes it that way. They don't want to be accused of robbery and stealing from their guest. Now, if it's somebody else in another section, that's all right. They'll steal money then, but not their guest. So they have wonderful times. Sociologists can go there and just be very much at home. Be very safe. But missionaries are a little bit afraid. Well, there it is. What would you do? If the Lord laid it on your heart to reach these Mohammedans, how would you go about it? Now, in Oriental religions, if we were discussing this, we would perhaps take up the doctrinal aspect of it, how we could reach them doctrinally. We haven't discussed that in this class. We're just discussing the method of approach, your missionary technique, if you want to put it that way. What would you do in this case? Let's say you are to be a missionary among Moros. What would you do? Would you go to a civilized area, start a church intended for Moros and invite them to come to you? Or would you go into a Moro area and start there? Or how would you start it? Would you just start by a church, or would you start with a school, or would you just start as a sociologist studying their religion and then sort of little by little inject some of your own? Or, I don't know. I have never had it laid on my heart to go alone. I don't know, do you have any people like that in Africa? Any tribes that are of that type?
I don't know.
I think this would not only be true of the Philippines, but I think anywhere you would find a predominantly Mohammedan culture, you would have very much the same type of problem. If you go to Pakistan, the country of Pakistan is Mohammedan. If you go to Syria, to Transjordan, to any Mohammedan country of that nature, Arabia, Persia, oh well, we don't have Persia now, Iraq or Iran, I think you would meet, I don't know, I haven't really studied too thoroughly those countries, but I think you would meet very much the same kind of problem, the very same type of thing. The only difference being that in the Philippines, these Moros are a little bit more backward in their civilization. Whereas they're more advanced in civilization. But the nature of the people are about the same.
But it seems to me that the Mohammedans can go to them why can't we?
Why can't we what? Go to them?
They can
come. I think we can. It's just all in knowing how, though. What can you do? If you go to Indonesia, it's the same thing. Mohammedan there, too. Java, Sumatra, those countries, it's all the same thing. Borneo, also Mohammedan. There's a real problem, isn't it? Well, let's think about it. Maybe we can come up with something before next class period. Then we'll go on to the pagans.